He said, you know, Aaron, he said, here's the deal. He said, we don't understand it. We don't know what to say, and we don't know what to do. But I do think that there are some white people that are really concerned and would love to try to be a solution to the problem.
Hi, everybody. It's Linda. You're in for a treat today. My guest is Aaron Layton. Aaron is a diversity consultant and facilitator with a company called Relate to Color, based in St. Louis, Missouri. For many years now, Aaron, who also has a Master of Divinity, has been having remarkably courageous conversations about race and social justice. I am looking forward to you hearing his perspective on what he has learned, and particularly the reason that he wrote his book, Dear White Christian. Now, regardless of your faith, I want you to please listen to, watch this conversation, because everything that he has to say relates to all of us as human beings, regardless of what our faith might or might not be. So sit back, relax, enjoy this conversation. I hope you will, as much as I did. Aaron, it is so wonderful to have you on our Voices Matter podcast. We met just recently. Thank you for agreeing to be on the show. We met recently when you were facilitating a conversation here in Houston. I'm in Houston and there are people all over, but it was great to have you talking about or facilitating this conversation about race and social justice.
Yeah.
So I want you to first share with our audience how you ended up doing this work. You have a Master of Divinity. Uh-huh. But share how you're doing this work and why it's so important right now.
Good question. Yeah, thanks for asking that. And by the way, it's great to be here, Linda, and be a part of this. This is definitely in my wheelhouse, things I love to talk about. So yeah, you're probably gonna have to stop me because I'll just keep going.
Oh, that's okay.
Well, the way that it started, actually getting started in this work, is I took a job at a school in St. Louis. It was a Christian school, 7 through 12. And this was back in 2008. And the school, grade school, was located in a predominantly white, affluent part of St. Louis. And once I arrived there, once I was hired, the head of school at the time let me know in a few different conversations that they wanted to increase the number of students of color and families of color. And that they also wanted to basically begin to help the staff and community just become more culturally insensitive awareness as it relates to, you know, minority students, peoples of color, and different mm-hmm. things like that. And his heart was genuine and right. And so, you know, we began to work together. I began to connect with other people who did this type of work in St. Louis. One of the things that I think that really helped and assisted me in this journey was kind of in my story. I say it like this, that I grew up in the black and white world kind of simultaneously. My family moved out of an urban area in St. Louis, moved to a suburb, kind of a working class suburb in St. Louis. But all of our family connections and our church and everything was still located in the city. And so we spent the week, you know, in the suburbs, that's where our school was. But then the weekends we were in St. Louis, we're in Wellston, we're in East St. Louis. And so growing up in these two worlds, I could see the disparities. I couldn't explain them. I couldn't explain the disparities that I saw in education, the type of schools that I saw in the city versus the schools in the county, the neighborhoods, things of that nature. You know, were high concentration of minorities, low income neighborhoods, and things like that. And so that lended to me having a view to say, you know, something about this is off, you know, even as a kid. And why does it seem like there are pockets of minorities who seem to be disadvantaged? And why is it like that? And why does it seem like there are other pockets in St. Louis, where there are many whites that it seems like are advantaged, you know. And so all that lended to me at Westminster beginning to do the work of as a director of diversity and begin to bring sensitivity and awareness to the school that I was at, and I'm currently still at that school. So that's how it all got started. And it as I continued with that, I decided that there was such a need that I created my organization, Relate to Color.
And what does Relate to Color do?
Yeah. So Relate to Color is an agency, and basically we do a variety of different things, and we work not exclusively, but primarily we'll work with churches, Christian organizations, Christian small groups, things like that. But we also work with, you know, businesses and corporate clients. But the whole idea is as the label says, Relate to Color, helping institutions, organizations, business relate to people of color. We do that through consulting. We do that through workshops, trainings. We put on community events, and all in the name of providing opportunities for people to have transformation into cultural awareness, and so that they eventually can be advocates and allies in their workspace, in their neighborhood, wherever they are. Yeah.
So when did you start your organization, and what was the catalyst?
Oh, wow. So, this is so interesting. So if you believe in providence, this definitely fits in that category. So I did the research. I had a brother-in-law who was a business guy, and he said, hey, you should come up with a plan. I can show you how to do it. But he said, do your research about who are the people that would need this, you know? And so I did all of those things, you know, and found out that major companies, corporations, all of them, firms, they all, you know, they have a D&I person either on staff or they bring in someone, you know? And so, but I saw that churches, Christian organizations, kind of the Christian world had really nothing like that. And so, it was summer of 2014 in June. I launched Relate to Color. I went to a national conference for, I think it was the PCA, Presbyterian Church of America. Went to their national conference and kind of pitched, set up a booth, you know. And so there wasn't much traction. You know, people were like, okay, that's kind of good. They didn't really see the need for it at the time. And so I come back home to St. Louis, and lo and behold, a month and a half later, you know, August 2014 hits, and we have the shooting of Michael Brown, and we have the Ferguson unrest. And providentially, from that time to this, there are that clientele or that population, white evangelical Christians, began to ask questions that I think they hadn't asked for a long, long time. Like, what is going on with the situation with Michael Brown, and what is going on with what's going on around the country? I thought we were beyond this. Very similar, not unlike what's happened recently with George Floyd, but a lot of good questions. And so at that time, that's when, you know, churches and Christian organizations slowly began to reach out to Relate to Color to kind of help them in this journey of understanding things.
And as you have been on this journey, you also decided to write a book called Dear White Christian. Yeah. And I'm going to read something here, that a quote from you about why you wrote the book. And it says, I wrote the book to reveal the emotional racial distance that can and often does exist between white and Black Christian friends and colleagues. I had unconsciously experienced this emotional distance for many years, but it became apparent after the death of Michael Brown and the Ferguson riots. In my world that was dominated by white Christian colleagues and friends, I wrestled with their silence. Mm. My book is personal and is written to allow white Christians and all who read it to look through the eyes of a Black Christian man to see why the emotional distance between white and Black Christians exists and what to do about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was the initial reaction?
Yeah. And let me just say, and I'm going to tell a little bit about the situation that revealed this distance, this emotional distance between me and my white brothers and sisters. And by the way, let me say this as it relates to the book. I mean, someone may be hearing this podcast and be like, okay, well, I'm not a Christian. I'm not a Christian.
Yeah.
But let me say this, really, you can take that out of the reason I wrote it to that particular segment is because I spent a lot of time, I've been called to this space. So I spent a lot of time, in white evangelical Christian America, but, all those same things for the most part apply, in this conversation,
regardless of your faith.
So here's the situation that revealed this emotional distance that I was unaware that was there. So when the death of Michael Brown occurred, of course, in the minority community, because for us, this is nothing new. It doesn't mean that it doesn't hurt as much, because it still does when we have these shootings and things that go on. But what I mean by it, there is nothing new, is like in the minority communities, we are not surprised by the interactions and the conflict that has happened, because it's happened for years, you know. And this is not a demonization of police force or anything like that, as much as it is just the reality of the minority experience in America as it relates to law enforcement. And so when this happened, there is always this buzz in the minority community and this pain and the trauma, because it's always attached to something historical. I think often our white brothers and sisters, they will see that direct incident and search to try to understand it, the rage and some of the pain and emotion. Whereas we are like, no, this is just a scab that's just been pulled off of this wound that goes way, 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 way back. You know, if you think about some of these major race riots in America, if you do just a basic search, you'll find that there are these conflicts that took place in neighborhoods for sometimes years and years and years between law enforcement and the minorities in those communities that lead to, usually there's an incident, right? And then we get a full, you know, kind of a full bolt thing. And so I'm talking with my family, I'm talking with my brothers and sisters, you know, in the minority communities, and we're just, you know, this is all over us. But then I would go to work or church where I'm in these predominantly white spaces, and there was radio silence, and I didn't understand what was going on with that. And so I began to get frustrated. I began to think things that I didn't know if they were true or not, but that was coming in my mind. I was thinking, do these white people not care because it's not their neighborhood? What's going on? Why are they not seeing anything? And I remember sitting down with my pastor, who's white, and I was serving at the time at a predominantly white church, and I was the only Black elder. And so I'm sitting down with my pastor and the group of elders, and they're trying to understand what's all that's going on and why there's so much anger. And I remember sitting across from these men, and I had worked with them probably for at least 2 years. And in that moment, they seemed like complete strangers to me. And I didn't understand why at the time. I was like, I don't understand, but they seem like strangers. They're asking me questions about like, we don't understand what's going on and all these different things. And then I realized that although we had a shared world experience, which was church, my experience and their experience in America, in that community, was drastically different. They felt like they knew me. They felt like they knew everything to know about me. Yet they didn't understand the pain. They didn't understand my fears for my son, who was 15 at the time, and my daughter, who was 13, and even the fears that I had for myself. And so I just, this incredible distance, because one of the deepest part of my identity, unfortunately, is that part of being a Black man in America, with the experiences that I've had, which, you know, they're not experiences that I've always wanted, but are there. But here are people that I am in community with that know nothing of that. And that's where that distance was coming from. Well, I felt like that distance emotionally was ripe to be exploited, because I'm like, if they don't know that these things are deep and important to me, and they run deep, then they don't understand why some of their questions could be harmful and hurtful to me. Right. Their defense of you know, the community that they're a part of, and the justifications for such things, but then at the same time asking all of the questions about, you know, what did Michael Brown do, right? You know, not that there aren't things
what did he do to cause that to happen to him?
Yes.
Right. Instead of looking at the opposite, right?
Yeah. And so I'm seeing that level of critique for Michael Brown, but I'm not seeing that same level of critique for Officer Wilson, you know. And so this distance is just growing, you know. And so it was then that I said, you know what? I see the problem. I could finally see the problem. And the problem was this: my experience, right, is drastically different from theirs. They only have their experience. And so for them to be able to kind of cross that chasm without me bringing them into it was quite a leap. And so I said, but if I can write this book, if we can begin to have dialogue, if we can sit down and I can tell you why I have the fears that I have about my son and even my daughter and myself, and if I can share the experience of why I am frustrated that we are here yet again, we can maybe close some of that emotional distance, and hopefully I can gain an advocate and an ally from you, you know?
So I was just going to say, you know, it's so interesting because we all have our lived experiences, and we live in a world where there is ironically instant communication. And yet there is such a lack of communication when it comes to this particular issue.
Yeah.
We do not talk to each other about our lived experience that is so germane to who we are as Black people. And then the same for the lived experience that is germane to what it means to be white in America.
Yeah.
We just assume that each other knows because you're living and working in the same environment, and there's media and there's coverage of all this stuff. And it's like, but don't you know what is really going on? And the reality is we don't, because we have never had, at least not in my lifetime that I can remember, this kind of real raw talk, conversation, sharing of our mutual experiences.
Yeah.
So when you decided, so before you wrote the book, I would assume that going from that conversation that you just described, where you had this epiphany, it's like, oh, okay, I get it now.
Yeah.
I understand what the distance is, where it's coming from. How did you address it in the moment?
Yeah. The one of the ways I addressed it is I simply went to one of my white brothers and I just simply asked the question. I said, I just got to ask you something. I said, do white people in the suburbs here in St. Louis, do they care about Michael Brown, and do they care about what's going on in Ferguson? I said, because I can't tell. I said, matter of fact, it feels to me as if you don't care because it's not occurring out here where you live. And I had a good relationship with my white friend, Scott. And I knew that he would be honest with me, even if he said, you know, yeah, man, it sucks. And, you know, but this is what he said. He said, you know, Aaron, he said, here's the deal. He said, we don't understand it. We don't know what to say. And we don't know what to do. But I do think that there are some white people that are really concerned and would love to try to be a solution to the problem. Well, when he said that, that hadn't occurred to me, that it could be that simple, that they didn't understand it. Like, you know, they're seeing what's happening. They didn't know what to say. They didn't know what to do. Not that they couldn't cognitively understand, but they didn't know like why these things were happening, why this was a big deal.
Right.
And so I turned to him and I said, you know what, Scott, if that is true, I said, then we can fix that, because I'm an educator. So I said, so we're just talking about education, getting the right people in a room and facilitating conversation and helping to bring transformation. If there are people out there that really want to learn. And so one of the first things I did was, I got a group of my African-American pastor friends who were pastoring, churches in the inner city in St. Louis. And said, hey, would you be willing to sit on a panel? I said, we are going to find a church in one of the whitest parts of St. Louis. We're going to invite the churches that, you know, often don't get down to this inner city that have the questions about, you know, Michael Brown and these issues of race. And I said, we'll just let their members of the church come to this event. They'll ask questions on cue cards. And I said, they'll be able to hear from you and from us those questions that they have concerning race, concerning, you know, all these different things. And so we put a forum together and the turnout was incredible. I was just like, I mean, it's like, it's what Scott said was true when he said he thought that there were white people in the suburbs, in the affluent suburbs, that wanted to lean in on this conversation. Well, when we put that event on, he was right. I mean, that church was filled, and probably, you know, probably 85 to 90% white affluent, church members, attended this event. And,
what was your main takeaway from that event? When you think back on it, what was the nugget that came out of it?
I think one of the nuggets that came out of it was, many of my white brothers and sisters that were there that evening, many of them did not grow up in minority communities, or they didn't grow up in communities where they were in contact with minorities. And if they were, it was just kind of nominal. And so that provided, you know, a kind of a buffer from the realities of what these Black pastors were telling them about in their own personal experience, but also the members of members of their congregation. Now, here's the interesting thing. One of the white members that came up to me afterwards, he said this. He said, you know, the thing that really touched me, or he actually said another word. He said that just really just kind of went through me. He said, when these questions were asked, you know, the people put the questions on these note cards. Actually, in the back of my book, I lay out, you know, a couple of different forms that we did, one of those forms in there. But anyway, the people would write on cards and they would submit them to me and I'd read these questions. But this guy afterwards, this white guy, he said, you know, what really impacted me, and he said, I can't get it out of my mind. He said, there were certain questions that were asked. And he said, you could see the visceral reaction from the Black pastors on the stage as you read these questions or you talked about these experiences. You could see, you know, and he said it just cut through a lot of the doubt that I had in my mind. He said it hit me in a place, you know, because these pastors are sharing these stories, you know.
So give me an example of a question that was asked that elicited a visceral reaction from the Black pastors on stage.
So one guy asked, he asked a question, or actually, I don't know who it was in the card. They asked a question about Black on Black crime. And the question, I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was just like, you know, what about Black on Black crime?
Yeah. What about Black people killing Black people in Chicago?
What about Black people?
How many times do we hear that?
Right? I know. Yeah. And he said, what about Black on Black crime? And he said, the question said, it said something. It was a statement in there too, where it said, no one is concerned about that. But yet when police, you know, and one of the pastors said, wait a minute. He said, before Michael Brown, he said, my church, which is in the inner city, he said, we did a candlelight vigil for one of our members who was an elderly, and she got caught in the crossfire, right? And she got struck with a bullet in the community. He said, we were holding a candlelight vigil and a march in our neighborhood. He said, but no one came down here to cover it. He said, you know why? They're not concerned about that. And I mean, you could just pastor, it's just coming out of him, you know, and he's just like, and so then, you know, the other pastors are chiming in, you know, to talk about, you know, like the view of the inner city, you know, and different things. And so you had these responses, you know, and then, you know, if they were, you know, questions about like, you know, like Michael Brown, I remember, maybe someone on the actually we had a lady on the panel who had taught Michael Brown, African-American female teacher, right? And she just began to talk about like push back against this view that had been presented. And so you have these people with these life experiences that are sharing, right? And they're sharing in, you know, the rawness of their emotion, you know, and they're challenging some of these questions that come forth. I don't remember at what point, but someone posed the question, you know, let's just swap Michael Brown out, right, for someone who's white. Does that change things for you? You know, mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. That's the type of, you know, right. But it was really good and rich, right? And you could see people as they were thinking, there were things they had never thought about before. A lot of them had just, I mean, honestly, and I mean, this happens all over and on both sides, but honestly, a lot of them had these talking points, right, that they'd heard from somewhere that they felt like ruled the day. Like if, you know, like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, like what about black on black crime?
Yeah. 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 Which I always tell people this, because I get that question. This is how I answer it. People say, you know, what about black on black crime? The first thing I say is, first of all, any crime that is committed should be dealt with in a legal way. Right. I said, so that's easy. And I said, you know what? You know, minorities, I said, blacks, we've never said that we didn't want the law to be enforced. I said, all that we ask is that those who are saying things like black on black crime should be consistent. Right. It is inconsistent with the way that you think to say black on black crime, because you've never said white on white crime, Hispanic on Hispanic crime, Asian on Asian crime. But yet here is another situation by which you are judging minorities by a different standard. All we're asking you to do is be consistent. Right. So we're going to talk.
That's
about
a great answer. That's I'm stealing that. I'm so stealing that.
Please do.
Yeah, that is a great answer. Yes. I love that.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry. Keep going.
So I said, you know, often that's what, you know, as minorities, I said, we are not asking for things to be different. We're just saying use the same metric. Right. Use the same metric. Use the same, you know, don't move the goalposts. You know, don't say mm-hmm. that this matters over here, but then it doesn't matter over here. Yeah.
Right. Right. And so it's, you know, my thing when people say, well, don't all lives matter, you know, speaking against the Black Lives Matter movement. I said, well, my answer to that is all lives matter when Black lives matter too.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's, you know, the whole point of the Black Lives Matter movement is what you just said, you know, don't judge us by a different standard. Yes, of course, all lives matter. Of course they do. Yeah. But the point is that Black lives matter, that Black lives have not mattered as much as any other life in America.
I think the easiest way, and you're absolutely right, the easy way I get into that conversation when someone says that, and I said, even just a cursory research, right, of just some major inequalities. Let's look at mm-hmm. education, right? Let's look at healthcare. Let's look at income gap. Let's look at wealth gap. Let's look at residential segregation, right? Even if you're just glancing and you look at what is the demographic, right, that is at the bottom of all of those categories.
Right.
And it tends to be poor blacks, right? You get some Hispanics in there too. And so the thing that I say is, based upon what we see in the research, it would seem like the lives of this demographic somehow matters less, because look at the level of inequality for this group, right?
Exactly.
And then you and I know that these are not things that just happen, right? This is legislation. People make decisions about this. People make decisions for or against, or people don't make decisions at all when they should, you know? So,
right. Which is why institutional racism exists.
Absolutely.
You know? So I want to go back to that session, the forum with the Black pastors and the predominantly white audience asking these questions after Michael Brown. What happened after that? How did the dynamic in the community change, if at all? What happened? And then I want to find out what happened between then and now.
Good question. Well, the interesting thing is, from that time, we actually decided to put on a couple more of these events, because we recognized that there is a desire to talk about this. And so that's when we started to say, okay, what type of other forms can we put together? So I think we did that one in November, right? And so then one of the Black pastors that was on our panel towards the end, he says, "Hey, I came out here to you this time." He says,
You're coming to my hood next time.
Next time, he said, "You're coming to my church," right? And so we set up another event, and this event was a dinner, and so we invited two. We had one church, the church that hosted that first one, which was out in the suburbs. We invited them to bring their congregation. We brought another church that was kind of mid-city that had a mixed congregation in it. This one pastor, his church was right in the heart of the city. And we did a meal there, but we also did round tables, discussion about race. Mm-hmm. So we did the meal together, and we intentionally mixed up the groups. You know, I was just like, okay, we need salt and pepper together, right?
Yeah, together. You can't sit with your peeps.
So that was thing. So we started providing these dialogues. And I think one of the things that we kind of gained momentum is people did begin to recognize, hey, I did not have that experience. And I was judging a group of people about that which I didn't know and understand their experience. To give you a perfect example, after we did the second forum, elderly white gentleman, I think I mentioned in my book, elderly white gentleman that was at the church in the suburbs. He goes down, they do the meal, and then they have this talk around table. So he was probably in his upper 70s. And he's sitting at this table with this Black gentleman that's probably in his 40s. And so this Black gentleman begins to tell him how he was in a neighborhood that was had a failing school, but he managed to graduate. He said no one in his family had ever gone to college. He said he went to a community college, and he said he ran out of money, so he had to stop. And he's talking about all these different hurdles. So this elderly white gentleman is just listening to this story, and it never occurred to him. And he told me this later. He came to me later and he said, just about every job that I received, he said, it was a byproduct of people my dad knew. He said, I never thought anything about it. And he said, so here I've been able to make a pretty good living. And he said, but I sat across from this African-American gentleman who shared with him this story. And I look at all of these hurdles he's had. He said, yet in my heart for years, I've judged people like him. I said that they were just lazy and they could have done the same thing. He said, I never realized that it was my dad's connections, right, that had afforded me these opportunities in life. And he said, man, I just never, and it's very contrite, right? And so we just figured if we can continue to put those things together, but we would also do this because we wanted to take advantage of the moment. We didn't want these to be one-off. So at the end of these events, we would always encourage people. Matter of fact, we would tell them, here is your assignment. The group of people that you were sitting around the table with, take out your phones, exchange contact information, and you have 3 weeks to get together to do coffee, to do lunch, or do dinner. And here is your friend for the rest of your life who's of a different ethnic group that you can continue to have dialogue with, but that you can also go to and ask about something you don't understand that may be occurring in the public.
So beautiful. Yeah. So beautiful. So please tell me that this has had an impact.
Yes.
Has this continued?
Yeah. Every once in a while I'll run into someone who'll say, yeah, you know, like, well, we still meet, this group stills meet, or they may not meet regularly, but they stay in contact. So let's say, for instance, one of the gentlemen, he wasn't at that group, but I did some work with his church. And so we began meeting. Well, months went by. Well, there was a high profile case here in St. Louis with Officer Stockley, Jason Stockley, you can Google it. But anyway, so this friend that I had connected with months ago, he was trying to understand the African American pastors that were basically protesting and say, this guy needs to, we won't accept anything but a guilty verdict. And so he was like, he didn't understand that. Well, he reached out to me, right? And so we put those type of connections in place because right. We saw that the magic of these conversations, having someone that you are connected to that can help you understand some of the things and share their experience, has these far reaching implications. But it also helped. We all go back to these kind of silos that we're a part of. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where some of these conversations occur. Some of these conversations that maybe demonize a certain group or don't give the benefit of the doubt in certain situations. And so when those people go back to, when some of my white brothers and sisters go back to those social circles, they are able to be an advocate to say, you know, I don't know if that is true of all African Americans at all place and all time. You know, I don't know that, or maybe they weren't doing anything. Maybe this is a situation where there is some conscious or unconscious mm-hmm. bias on the part of the police officer. So helping people to be in those places, and that goes both ways. I mean, right. One of the things that I learned about my white brothers and sisters is many of them were taught that being colorblind was the goal. And what colorblind meant was you never brought up anything about anyone's race. So if you had an African-American friend,
right.
Linda's my friend and I'm white, mm-hmm. right?
Oh, I don't see color.
I don't see color.
She's not black to me.
She's not right. black. And you know what? Right. I am not going to bring up any subject that right. communicates to Linda that I know she's black, right? right? And so they think that that's, but I didn't know that. So I'm like, well, that explains yeah. it. That explains yeah. why when a mm-hmm. topic of race comes up, it's like, you know, yeah. And we as minorities are like, do you yeah. not see that?
Right. Do you not see all of me, you know, exactly. including my skin color and what that means in this yeah. society?
Yeah.
So it just, you know, it all comes back to human connection. Yeah. It all comes back to our ability or inability to look at each other as human beings and connect on that human level.
Yeah.
So
to your point, okay. So make sure I answer your question. So yes, some of those things are still going on. What we found out, like we just, this was in these events, is what we found out is there are many, many people, right, who are wanting to have these conversations, but they want to have them in a safe place and they don't know where to go. And so like if you relate to color, if you go on my website, you'll see some of these. We continue like we'll in St. Louis, like we target neighborhoods where there's, you know, where there's not a lot of minorities. We'll go to that neighborhood. We'll find a church or some other venue. We'll show a movie like we did The Hate U Give. Right. We invite people to come out and then we facilitate, me and my team will facilitate discussions. And so here are these opportunities for people that say, hey, I would never have an opportunity like this. And so we've seen that works in transforming people's hearts and minds. And so we did back in February before the COVID, so it'll be a while before we could do it again. We did the Emmanuel documentary that Viola Davis and Steph Curry were behind about the Emmanuel AME shooting in 2015.
Yes, yes.
So, and we open up to community. So we'll do press release on the radio and everything, invite people out. So you get a hodgepodge of people coming from
all over. And this can be done in every community.
Yes.
In every community. It's how we get to know each other.
Yeah.
So, okay. I have to ask, after George Floyd, what was the reaction among the group of people that that you are with, that are in your sphere, versus what happened post Michael Brown?
Great.
Did you see any difference in the dynamics that were going on?
Yes. Yes. I'm glad to report this. Yes. Okay. I can tell you, and I mentioned a little of this in my book on the front end about, you know, what are things that, you know, minorities meet in these times. My emails and my text messages from my white brothers and sisters, man, they leaned in. Mm. They were like, how are you doing? I'm seeing this. This is breaking my heart. I got texts. Like all of us. And by the way, Linda, I was in a very, very dark place. I was really sad. Yeah. I was just like, man, I cannot believe this is happening. Yeah. But it was so encouraging. My white colleagues here at the school I work at, Westminster, I am getting these texts like back to back to back, you know, praying for you. I am so sorry. What can I do? You know, what can I read? I mean, and it was, I'm like, you know, so like even in my sadness and my anger, you know, these text messages are coming, these emails are coming, you know, and then I even have, you know, colleagues calling to share, you know, some of the things that they've been inspired to do. So yeah, I have to say,
so this is the fruit of the labor that had been done 6 years prior.
Yeah.
So it gives me chills to think about that. It truly does.
Yeah.
Because it's so hopeful.
Yeah.
You know, we can get there.
Yeah.
This is evidence of it right here. This, your testimony is evidence of it.
Let me see if you don't mind, I have a little folder of emails. I want to read one of these emails.
Oh, please. I would love that.
Let me grab it really quick.
You know, the whole idea of people reaching out and saying, how are you?
Yeah.
How are you doing? You know, how are you feeling? What can I do? It's just phenomenal to me. And just the knowledge that the seeds that you planted and the relationships that were formulated over those 6 years since the Michael Brown incident.
Yes.
Wow.
All right.
Wow. And so you're teaching, your day job is teaching at a school. Yes.
Yes. All right. Here I found one of them.
Yeah. Okay.
And so this was after when we came back to school and I shared, I was very vulnerable about how I was feeling some of the trauma. And this is one of the emails I got from my colleague. And she said, I never got a chance in the chaos of school to follow up with you about your Wednesday talk, your Wednesday morning talk. You have no idea how much I appreciate your honesty and willingness to share. I know these are hard and sensitive topics to talk about with a lot of pain attached to them. Your willingness to be open and vulnerable about your experiences helps all of us learn and grow. However, when I listen to your stories, it breaks my heart. Your humility and grace is astonishing to me. Aaron, I'm so thankful for you, and I value your friendship for so many reasons. One of those many reasons is for ways you have helped me grow in my understanding of race and culture due to your willingness to have open and honest conversations. God is using you in a mighty way, my friend, in my life and as well as in our school. Yeah.
Yeah.
Touching stuff. Oh. Yeah. So that makes it, like you said, it's not in vain.
it's not in vain. And I think that that whole concept of vulnerability, you know, being open enough to let people in. Yeah. It's something that we as Black people need to do. Yeah. And it's something that our white brothers and sisters also need to do. Yeah. We have to be willing to open up.
Yeah.
And you know, share. Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting that you say about that is another thing that I found out in these dialogues is if you can peel back the pain and let them see the pain, often the easier secondary emotion is the anger. And I found out with generally, and this is not across the board, but generally with whites, when I work with whites, like anger in the way that I think as minorities, we express it, anger is hard for them to relate and connect to because in much of their culture, they are taught to suppress. They're not, you know, it's just like, okay, you know, I was reading this book called Waking Up White, and this lady who's a New Englander, and she's talking about how basically she became woke, and she's talking about some of the cultural things that she learned where you didn't show emotion. If you were upset about mm-hmm. something, she got sent to her room, right? What is that communicating? That socialization is, no, you keep it under control. Even if you are feeling something emotionally, you don't ever express it. So mm-hmm. what I learned from some of my white brothers and sisters is, yeah, I may be feeling a certain way on the side, but I hold that in. Well, if I know that, you know, then I'm like, okay. And so to the point that I was making is that anger piece, sometimes it immobilizes them because they have been taught the other about controlling emotions. But peeling back, you know, and showing them the pain often makes a connection, you know, that, you know, particularly like when they know someone, like they know me and we're vulnerable. Like you said, we need to do it more as African-Americans, as minorities, to talk about that pain. That strikes a chord. I think it was one of the things that really kind of blew the top off as far as like the protests and the identification with the George Floyd situation was, I've heard more than a number of white women say it was him calling for his mother
right.
that broke something in me.
Right.
Because I could relate to that. And then he was humanized. And then it was exactly. like, oh my goodness, mm-hmm. what, how could mm-hmm. this happen? Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. often that pain, you know, like, because if you think about it, you can think about other situations with, you know, African-American men who have been apprehended and there's a struggle, right? And so in right. some of their minds, unconsciously, he is fulfilling that narrative, right?
He's exactly,
you know, right. right?
Why doesn't he just acquiesce? Why doesn't he just exactly. do what the officer says to do?
Exactly. Right. And so sometimes right. that.
Why
that,
doesn't he hold it in?
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. so a lot of times that keeps them, but that particular situation where, I mean, George Floyd was just broken. It was just like, here's someone where they could recognize he ain't doing nothing, right? He's kidding, you know? So yeah. Yeah. So yeah. sometimes peeling back to show the pain versus the anger. And there's definitely a time for the anger, but sometimes it's hard for people to interpret that because culturally.
Well, that's how, you know, so when the protests, that the vast majority of which have been peaceful. And then when there is a riot, that's the anger.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
that's the anger piece.
Yeah.
And so, wow, I could talk to you all day. I guess I'd like to kind of wrap things up and ask you to leave our audience with a sense of hope for the moment that we're in now, because this, as you just were saying, this feels different
yep.
than it did after Michael Brown and,
yep.
and probably because of some of the work that you've been doing. And I'm sure others are also yep. doing around the country. And there've been conversations happening, you know, beneath the surface.
Yeah.
What is it about this moment that makes it different? And what is it that is going to keep it in the forefront so that we don't have the fatigue that always sets in when we start to talk about this topic?
Yeah. I think what is different, And I'll cut to the chase. So with the protests after George Floyd, I have never seen so many white people protesting in my life. Mm-hmm. With Michael Brown, I saw it a little bit. But it wasn't like George Floyd. Like, so my two kids, they went to a protest. Actually, my son did two, and my daughter did one. And both of them came home, and both of them said, "Dad, it was more white people than black people." They were like, "I couldn't believe it. They were great." There was like, my son was like, he said, "Dad, I saw like priests, you know, in their robes and clerical collars." And he's like, "Man, they're in there, you know." there's clearly a cultural shift there. I think one of the things that we need to be mindful of, and like you said, so the fatigue doesn't set in and we just, you know, is recognizing that, like, the intentional efforts to continue to talk to one another and learn. The key, like, we depending on what culture you come from, you tend to be socialized from your family members and friends about other groups. Mm-hmm. And if you don't challenge some things, particularly the things that are stereotypical, that are not wrong, or at least are not true of every person in that social group. But I think that the most transformative work and the most rewarding work is the work first and foremost of self-exploration, right? So often we're so afraid to lean into, you know what? If I'm being honest with myself, start with yourself. I do have those thoughts about that group of people. I do. I'm not happy about it. I don't know where it came from. I don't think it's fair, but I do. Right. But you know what? I'm working against that because I know that can't possibly be true about every person in that demographic group at all places at all time. Right. But often we don't challenge those things. So when people are talking about, you know, like they want to do something, and if they're really sincere, I'll tell them the most transformative work you can do is to begin to explore, who do I consider the other? All of us have others, all of us. And to really explore and deconstruct that. But as long as you say, no, I treat everybody the same. I don't ever, you know, like, just by human nature, we are creatures of conscious and unconscious bias. But if you don't acknowledge it, that makes you dangerous. If you acknowledge it, then you can deconstruct it and you can think differently. Right. So we're in a moment. More people, I think, are aware of systemic racism things more than ever. We still need to have these conversations. But also, we also need those who are in positions of power to be advocates and allies. And it is going to cost you something. It's going to cost you clout in your social group. That's why not many people are willing to do it. But it is what you should be done. And it's that which that will really move us forward as a country, you know, to a more inclusive nation and communities. Yeah.
So beautifully said. And we're having this conversation about 10 days before the presidential election. And everything that you just said is going to be more important than ever as we come out of this election, regardless of who wins.
Yes.
Because the divisions that are there are so deep. And you know, we need to have these conversations and remind ourselves of our common humanity and come from that place, stop the demonization, stop the othering, and just, you know, look at each other as human beings, because we have to get through this together.
Yeah, absolutely. I love how you said that. I'll say this quickly as we wrap up. I tell people this: any solution is a community solution. So I tell people, like, if you're coming to one of our conversations and you are thinking that there is a solution without the police, there isn't one, not a good one. It includes the police. Now, I absolutely think there should be police reform. I absolutely think this idea of these internal investigations, right? I do think that there should be third party investigations. I do think that there are certain cultures, police cultures, that over the years, just like any other culture, every institution has a culture. Some of those cultures have developed into some bad culture, right? And those things need to be challenged. But having said that, the solutions within a community, it is a community problem, right? And the media also has a part to play. Like everybody's got a part to play.
Huge part. That's a whole nother series of podcasts that we could do on that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Media is a big part of it. Yeah. Aaron, this has been such an amazing, enlightening, fulfilling conversation me, for sure. And I'm sure for our audience as well. The book is Dear White Christian, Go Get It. Yeah. And again, regardless of whether you are Christian, the point is everything that we've talked about here is about human connection.
Yes.
And that's the bottom line.
Yep.
That is the bottom line. Aaron Layton, you are a gem. Thank you so much.
Good to be here.
I'm so happy to be in your world. Just understand you're never getting rid of me now. Okay.
No problem.
Connected. Okay.
No problem. We'll do some good work together.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. I am so ready. Thank you so well. Be well and be blessed.
Same to you. Be well. All right.
Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, I don't know about you, but I really needed that. I needed to feel a sense of hope for our future and understanding that the conversations that we have on this podcast and that so many like Aaron and those that he works with are having these deep, raw, real conversations aimed at helping us understand each other as humans, helping us to stop demonizing and stop otherizing. It gives me hope that we are going to get through this period of division that we find ourselves in right now. Let's just keep talking, people. Please, let's just keep talking. Thank you for giving Aaron permission to speak and for having the courage to listen with an open mind. We'll see you next time.